from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in the hour ahead, Argentinian author Jorge Luis Borges once wrote, "I have always imagined that paradise will be a kind of library." Library historian Wayne Wiegand's new book, Part of Our Lives, A People's History of the American Public Library, explores the library's influence as a civil and social space. And we'll discuss his book and why libraries are still flourishing in the Internet age. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. You might assume you could not find 95% of Americans over the age of 16 who agree on anything, but according to a Pew poll, 95% do agree that material and resources available in public libraries play an important role in giving everyone a chance to succeed. And much to the surprise of those who said the rise of the Internet would possibly kill libraries off, many are more popular as ever. William Wiegand has given us a history of public libraries in America in his book, Part of Our Lives. Excuse me, make that Wayne Wiegand. He's a professor emeritus of library and information studies at Florida State University, now living here in the Bay Area, and author of a number of books, former director of the Florida Book Awards. And we welcome him to the second hour of Forum. Glad to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
This book struck so many chords, and I know Will and our listeners, we're going to actually invite you, our listeners, to talk about the impact libraries have had in your life or just how it may have changed your lives. It certainly did mine. It became a haven, as it did for many people who were eventually on a trajectory toward an academic life or an intellectual life. But what I learned a lot from your book. What I learned above all, I suppose, is that libraries changed a great deal because of the users of libraries.
Well, one of the things that people often forget about public libraries is that the members of the public don't have to use them. So because they don't have to use them, librarians have to respond in some way to what they want. And over time, as you can see from the book, a lot of what they wanted was fiction. A lot of what they wanted was a place to meet for community activities. And so they, in effect, influenced the profile, the contours, and the services of the American Public Library.
And influenced the librarians who thought maybe they would like popular fiction or things.
That is correct. That was a huge battle in the late 19th and early 20th century.
In fact, this responsiveness to the public, and I think you bank a lot on the idea that libraries will be sustained and will have a future because they have been responsive over the years, going back to, back over a century. But this has been a major theme, as has something else in your book, and that is the transformative effect that libraries have, not only in communities but on individuals.
Indeed. That transformative effect comes through so many venues, too. It comes through meeting your friends at the library after school. It comes to sitting in a children's room listening to a story. It comes through reading genre fiction, a great story about Sonia Sotomayor reading Nancy Drew, and based on what she read and how she played with the text, deciding law was a career for her.
She actually mentioned that story when we did the interview with her not long after her appointment to the Supreme Court, after her book came out. But Nancy Drew actually had some problems, didn't it, in terms of censorship?
Indeed. The librarians, many of them, especially the professional librarians in large urban institutions, such as the San Francisco Public Library, did not stock Nancy Drew. I remember reading an account on the San Francisco Chronicle, for example, when the new library opened up in the middle of the 1990s, where a girl, Taya Bosselman, I hope she still lives in the San Francisco area, wrote a letter to the editor of the Chronicle saying, "I can't find Nancy Drew in the San Francisco Public Library system. My mother read her, and my grandmother read her, and I can't understand why I can't read her out of the library collections." Well, the librarians were sort of put on the spot, and shortly thereafter, they started stalking Nancy Drew.
There are those stories of library censorship. I mean, Huckleberry Finn, for example, still problems that some people have with the N-word in there. The Jungle by Upton Sinclair and the Sexual Behavior of the Human Male. I remember in Athens, Ohio, asking a librarian for Croft Ebbing. I was interested in the time, and these are case studies of all kinds of strange behaviors, and they had it under lock and key. I mean, you had to actually go up in the stacks and like you were doing some kind of bank, under guard almost, literally.
Indeed, back in the 19th century, they called that the inferno. And over time, that phrase sort of changed. It was a privileged shelf. It was a secluded shelf. It was the locked case. So there are, and they still exist today. There are. Most libraries have some kind of a shelf where material is placed that all members of the public can't necessarily have access to. It was a compromise position that librarians managed to negotiate that still that allowed controversial materials to still be accessible to some individuals.
You mentioned the San Francisco Library. Of course, there have been a couple of major stories around the San Francisco Public Library that we talked about. I mean, we've talked about libraries through the years that I've been on the air, largely because I'm a major advocate and supporter of libraries and believe in them strongly. But one story that came up was, you may remember, Nicholson Baker saying,
indeed,
you know, there are too many books. The library said there were too many books, and they wanted to do away with a lot of those books. And Baker became kind of a one-man crusade. But there was also a lot of controversy over homeless people coming, not only here in San Francisco, but throughout the country. I remember a big case in New Jersey, in fact.
The issue of homeless in American public libraries goes back to the first day that the Boston Public Library opened in 1854. Homeless people have always been a part, especially of urban public library history. Now, I wouldn't say that they are a solution, but they are certainly a part of the homeless person's life. The library does give answer some needs that homeless person has. There are also, public library history also is full of success stories of individuals who at one time in their life were forced to be homeless and use library services and library collections to make themselves into middle-class successes.
We're talking with Wayne A. Wiegan. He is Professor Emeritus of Library and Information Studies at Florida State, now lives here in the Bay Area, and is the author of Part of Our Lives, A People's History of the American Public Library. And we ought to mention that 2 out of 3 Americans at least go once a year to a library, and still a great number have those cards or are somehow borrowers at least at one point or another and keep the cards ensconced and a part of their wallet or whatever. You know, there was a point, Wayne, where people were saying it's just not going to get the public support. Libraries are becoming obsolescent. They're going to go like the dodo bird. And I remember down in Southern California, they even had, you know, tin cups out. People, I mean, I'm being somewhat figurative here, but, you know, asking for money because the money just wasn't there. And now libraries have become really robust again, and there are so many. In fact, I think there may be more than ever?
There are more than ever. Latest statistics we have are that there are 17,219 public libraries in the United States. Now, that includes branches and bookmobiles, and that's more than there ever were before. In fact, that's 3,000 more than there are McDonald's restaurants in the United States.
So we can attribute this to libraries not only being responsive to users, but also keeping in step with the digital age?
Indeed. I would caution individuals to not judge libraries based solely on what is happening in digital information, because libraries do so much more for their communities, and their communities regard what they do as essential services than digital information. It's so much more than information access, if my history is an accurate representation.
Yeah, Philip Roth, whose first book had to do with libraries, the protagonist was a librarian, and there was a young black kid in there who went to the library to look at pictures of Gauguin, and he talked about that, as Roth talked about, not in the novel, but in his own writing, about how important libraries were to him in terms of making him understand community and citizenship and just the effect on Well, the commons that the library represent. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's free and it's public and it teaches you a lot about responsibility. I mean, there's all of that that goes into, I suppose, what we think about as what the library has to offer. Even including, I learned from reading your book and some other things recently, gaming. Libraries, about 15-20% of libraries now have games as a way of providing learning.
And that's not new. Some suburban libraries in Minneapolis, Minnesota were already issuing games in the late 19th century. Different games, of course, but still games.
Well, there's so much to learn from your book, and it was a pleasure to not only find out about the whole history of libraries and learn so much on that score, but also since I mentioned Roth and Gauguin and the kid, the black kid and African-American kid in that book, there was a report recently out of New York, which I'm sure you may be familiar with, about the racial divide with librarians, that they look differently at people of color who come into libraries than they do it at Caucasians. And also some data about this in a Pew poll. Over 50% of blacks and Hispanics said libraries are good for helping with jobs, looking for jobs, but only 20% of whites and Asian Americans. So there is a racial divide, always has been.
For public libraries, the group that benefits the most from public library services are generally the poorest in the community. So immigrants who come to Chicago, come to San Francisco, come to Los Angeles, you'll see them in larger numbers per capita than you would white Americans who have settled. The public library has been used as a way to increase your opportunities for jobs, etc. So I'm not surprised by that. And one must also remember public library employees are no different than a lot of other Americans. White library employees carry with them the same kind of baggage that white parks and recreation people carry. So you're going to find attitudes towards people reflective of the population in general there.
The other thing about libraries that certainly occurred to me is you start off early on. I mean, it's important in child development. You get a library card. You learn to, like I did as a kid, you know, go to the library and just spend time there. But it's also got a very central and integral role now in lifelong learning.
Indeed. And again, Michael, I'm going to sort of argue with you. It always has. And I can provide you with anecdote after anecdote to
you're the
to
historian.
Demonstrate that. Yeah.
I may be thinking too contemporaneously, but it's the idea of it's being free and public, which, by the way, is true of public radio, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the things we take pride into and we're educational. What if you can, though, account for what allowed we've been talking about the importance of users and so forth, getting in step with technology. But what allowed for this shift where libraries even became more popular post-internet? Because they have, haven't they?
When you take a look at the use statistics, and we haven't done a very good job in the library profession of gathering statistics on a consistent basis since they started. I can tell you that there are more public libraries now than ever before, and I can tell you that there hasn't been a year where there hasn't been an increase. At the beginning of the Great Depression, for example, if you compare it to the end of the Great Depression, there were 800 more libraries, public libraries. So the numbers of libraries have increased. What we haven't done a good job of is counting the number of people who cross the threshold of a public library. We've only started counting those numbers in recent years, so those numbers kind of surprise us with their increases. The same thing with counting people who have attended public programs in the public libraries, which have been consistent since the middle of the 19th century. We just didn't count them before. So having the numbers in the 21st century kind of surprises us, but if my history is any indication, it shouldn't surprise us because those numbers were there prior to the 21st century.
Well, in the 21st century, we have libraries fulfilling not only all these community resources that you're talking about and events and social, but the fact of the matter is I read a quote, and I don't even know who it's attributed to. Two institutional places that affect you the most powerfully when you're young: the church, which belongs to God. I know all my atheist and agnostic listeners will recoil when they hear that, but this is some wise man or would-be wise man. And they said, and the library, which belongs to you.
And I'm not sure where you got that quote, but if you read the first part of the book, David McCullough, Martin Luther King, Kurt Vonnegut, all those, Philip Roth would agree with that particular quote. The library's there. It gives you what you want. You get from it what you want.
Yeah, and Keith Richards, as Irene reminds me, and in fact, you can go through so many of these stories. I don't know if you're familiar with the story of August Wilson, probably a famous playwright who actually told me this story on the air, that he did an essay in school on Napoleon, and the teacher implied that he did not write the essay, and he was outraged and wound up playing hooky from school and not wanting to go to school. And he spent all his time in the library, and the library, he said, had more to do with forming him, one of our most important playwrights, really, of the 20th century and early 21st century, than anything he'd ever experienced. And then I love the story, well, the quote of Germain Greer said, you can lose your innocence in the library, but not your virginity.
But you can. And that's happened before, too.
Oh, I'm sure. There are stories up in the stacks, which reminds me of the story of Thomas Wolfe, you know, the gargantuan You Can't Go Home Again and all those kind of books where he wrote mainly about himself. But, you know, the story was he was teaching at NYU and he was grading papers, and they used to say that Wolf wrote more on the papers than the students wrote. But he would go up in the stacks and he would read and he would get lost in what he was reading, and then he would say, this is not reality. I have to, you know, leave the library and go out and experience reality. And then he would say, no, I prefer art and literature. And he would race up to the stacks again. And then he would go out back and forth and back and forth with this inimitable energy that he had. It's a place where everybody almost has a story. And I'm sure we're going to hear them from our listeners.
And I'll just observe from the anecdotes that you've quoted to me, Michael, how relatively few of them have anything to do with information technology.
Well, of course, that's the history that we go back to. Talk about the early origins of the library. You've kind of alluded to it, but what brought it into being? Its genesis.
It's a complicated question to answer because a whole lot of things came together at a particular moment in time and at a particular place. I would say a major reason, however, was in the city of Boston, the Irish Americans who were flooding into the city were perplexing the elite, the Boston Brahmins, they're often referred to, and they were looking for ways to make sure that the future would look as good as the present. And a way they thought this would be addressed was to make these Irish Americans informed, if possible, and offering free information in that the time, of course, in the form of printed works.
So the Brahmins were going to civilize the Irish refugees.
They were going to inform them so they would vote correctly, intelligently.
Make them good citizens.
Yes, a very Jeffersonian thing to do.
And so the library came out of that. I mean, let's get into the sense of, you know, building a library. Where did the funds initially come from?
Taxes on local real estate. The profile of the public library funding hasn't changed significantly. It was accelerated, certainly, by Andrew Carnegie in the late 19th, early 20th century, and then again with federal monies that came in through the Great Society programs of Lyndon Johnson. External sources certainly do help, but even today, 85 to 90% of most local public library financing comes from local real estate taxes.
Where did the libraries go, though, from being a place to sort of inform and create better citizenship to a civic institution, what it is today, a public place that really promotes community generally?
That occurred in the late 19th and early 20th century, and I would say the culmination of that really was what public libraries did during World War I. They were places where individuals would create bandages for servicemen. Community people would gather there in the community rooms of the public libraries. The public libraries would provide information on how to conserve food so that more food could go to servicemen abroad, etc. The First World War really was the culminating factor in library as community center. An irony here is the model came out of two branches in the Louisville Public Library system that were African-American branches. And a reason for that, of course, is that in a segregated Louisville society in the early 20th century, there were very few public places African-Americans could go. So the African-American director of those two branch libraries decided he would make his public libraries, both Carnegie buildings, into community centers. And the model was emulated by others.
We're talking to Wayne Wiegand. His book is Part of Our Lives, A People's History of the American Public Library, and we'll bring our listeners into this. But I want to read an email from a listener. We've been talking, you know, bullishly about libraries. Obviously, we're both supporters, fans, and all that. But looking at a listener's comment here, the library is a civil and social space. Oh, please. San Francisco Public Library is a de facto homeless shelter, mental ward, and daycare center. Oh, yeah, and drunk tank. And by the way, we should mention here, San Francisco has the nation's first full-time library social worker. That's Leah Esquera. But have you heard this?
Yeah. And how do I respond to it? Have her try another library. And what is she really seeing the entire picture? Is she seeing the number of immigrants who are enrolled in the San Francisco Public Library online high school diploma program? Is she seeing the individuals who are trying to learn how to operate a computer? Just walking in the door and looking from one wall to the other doesn't capture what happens in a public library.
Literacy programs and other programs really that are involved in, of course, advancing reading and advancing knowledge in so many different ways. Here's another listener who says, I used to love going to the library to read books and learn new things. That's a lot more difficult in San Francisco now because the library stinks to high heaven and the bathrooms are positively dangerous. Can't this wealthy city come up with better places for the derelicts to spend their day? Who wants to touch books or even chairs that have been handled by people who haven't bathed in over a week? The security guards have to make regular rounds to wake these people up and or stop them from watching porn on library computers, which others can easily see. I used to go to meetings there that provided much-needed services for language learners, writers, tenants, and so on, but now I don't feel safe there. And this is what we're hearing initially before I've even given out the phone number or told people how they can communicate. Let me do that now, by the way. Some of you may have something to say along those lines. But also, as I said earlier, I'd like to hear from you about the effect libraries have had on you or the impact that libraries had on your lives or continue to have on your lives. And you can join us at our toll-free number. It's available right now. It's 866-733-6786. And we do, again, welcome your phone calls, so feel free to join us by calling 866-733-6786. You can also, of course, email us forum@kqed.org or post questions or comments onto our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment. And you can also, of course, tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. We're talking again with William Wiegand, and he is the author of Wayne Wiegand. I keep wanting to make you a William, and I should want to make you another Wiegand because, you know, we've got David Wiegand, the famous editor of the San Francisco Chronicle. I'm thinking if I know a William Wiegand. Anyway, it's Wayne Wiegand, Wayne A. Wiegand, and he's Professor Emeritus of Library and Information Studies at Florida State and the author of Part of Our Lives, A People's History of the American Public Library. We'll hear from you, our listeners, when we return, and stay tuned. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. I quoted author Jorge Luis Borges earlier. I have always imagined that paradise will be a kind of library, and he should know he was a librarian historian, Wayne Wiegand, with us talking about his book, Part of Our Lives, A People's History of the American Public Library, and we certainly welcome your involvement in the program. Again, you can join us by calling us toll-free 866-733-6786 or emailing us forum@kqed.org or going to our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm going to go right to your calls and emails, but before I do, Professor Wiegand wanted to say something about those last comments, which were coming in strong about, the San Francisco Public Library being a place of that you don't even want to go into.
Oh, yeah. I read almost the same language of an individual who was complaining about the Chicago Public Library in 1895. This is not unusual for people to complain about what the homeless is as an issue in public libraries. But I want to also remind individuals listening, I remember specifically in the Great Depression, I was reading an annual report in the St. Louis Public Library written in the Great Depression, and the librarians in a branch knew very well that they had certain rules and regulations they were to follow on use of the bathroom. And they watched this 8-year-old girl come in with her little 2-year-old sister tagging along behind her and going into the bathroom. And they knew very well what was happening in there. That was the only bath that kid got for the entire week. And they couldn't bring themselves to enforce the rules and regulations and let that kid do it for weeks on end. That's a humane way to treat an issue. And I really applaud the St. Louis public librarian who turned her back on what she should have enforced as a bureaucratic set of rules and practices.
On the other hand, I do remember, it may have been in Rutherford or one of those cities in New Jersey, you might recall better than I do, where there was a big lawsuit and brouhaha over a homeless guy who was there who was, as they argued, smelling up the place, or words to that effect, and finally brought a court order and fought through the legal system and essentially got him evicted. They did.
There was a settlement, and it was in Madison, New Jersey. There was a settlement, and he agreed not to come back to the library.
When I think of rules and regulations library, probably like most people, I think of librarians going, shh, you know, be quiet, or having to pay fines.
Yes, the shushing librarian is a stereotype, boy, that we really ought to discard if possible.
You have too many cartoons and too much history behind it in popular culture, but worthy of discarding. Milad is our first caller here. Good morning.
Hi, this is Milad. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to share my story about when I was 18. I came here to United States from Iran. I was a high school dropout. I needed a job, but I didn't want to work, if you know what I mean. So I thought I'll get a job at the local public library so I can, you know, shelf books and hide between these stacks, and that entirely changed my life. Years later, I was promoted to a library clerk and then a librarian assistant. I went back to school. I got my engineering degree, and I always thought that this is a privilege that people of the United States and Americans have. This library broke my heart how back home we didn't have such a system. It was not promoted. Reading was not important for at least my parents back home. But I absolutely love it, and that is something that I'm going to push on my kids. And that's how I went back to school, and I learned to speak English, and I learned how to read English through the library system of Orange County down in California.
That's a sweet story. I'm glad you shared it with us.
And your story is repeated tens of thousands of times in American public library history.
Thank you, Milad, for that story. Actually, here's Teresa, who writes, my great-great-aunt, Gracia Countryman, led the Minneapolis Public Library from 1902 to 1936. A homeless boy came into the library often, and though Gracia was unmarried, she adopted him. This was quite unusual at the time, but she was impressed by his love of books, and he grew up to be a successful family man.
And you should be very proud of Gracia. She is one of the heroines of American library history.
We'll go to more of our callers, and we'll welcome Jed. You're on. Good morning.
Hi. Thank you, Michael. A long-time listener, first-time caller.
Welcome again, Dean.
Hey, I represent the Satanic Temple, the San Jose chapter, and we are very, very secular, civic-minded people, and we get a lot of work done through the library. It's the only place we can safely meet without repercussions from, you know, fundamentalist people that don't understand what we do. And we also manage to get a lot of information about helping homeless people, animal advocacy, and LGBT issues through the library.
And as Satanists, you are also activists in those three areas?
Oh, absolutely. It's a national organization, and each chapter in each city focuses on different issues, and the San Jose chapter, which there is an article in the Metro today about us, we focus on animal advocacy, homelessness, and LGBT issues.
But forgive me, one would almost automatically or reflexively ask, is that supposed to be the work of Satan or on behalf of Satan? Those are good causes. People would say, why are you involved in good causes if you're a Satanist?
Well, check this out. We believe that evil is animal suffering, human suffering, and people being discriminated against. So that is the evil that we fight against.
Well, then you're my kind of people. But I'm glad you called, and I'm glad that the library is giving you a safe sanctuary, which is true for lots of groups that are kind of out there on the fringes, wouldn't you say, Wayne Wiegand?
I would say that the very people that oppose this group of Satanists can also use public library services and collections for their own agendas.
And here's Dave, who writes, may I put in a plug for the importance of school libraries? I will never forget the library in my high school, San Juan High, Citrus Heights. I would hang out there in my lunch period and pore over Life magazines from World War II period, among many other things, with other nerds like myself. This was my introduction into the world of literature, art, and the entire world. And we asked our listeners on social media what they love about their local libraries, and let me read some of the responses. I take my toddler, Emily tweets, to a story time at the Bayview branch at Richmond. Where else can you get a fun, free, educational weekly activity? Here's Michelle, who writes, my grandmother used to go to her local library to use the internet and send emails. She was in her 80s. She never owned her own computer, but became very skilled at doing research, emailing, and keeping up on current events via the local library's computer. As for myself, years ago, I moved into my condo and realized over half the weight of my belongings were books, so I decided to only purchase books selectively and instead used the local library for most of my pleasure reading. So grateful for the community service that they provide. And Keith says, what do you think of public libraries maintaining collections of video DVDs? Our libraries in Marin County maintain a huge selection, and now that video stores have closed, it's a way to access a huge segment of our cultural heritage. But, of course, DVDs are getting obsolete, too.
They are. Yeah. The public libraries have been part of the media movement ever since print took other forms. They were circulating player piano rolls in the late 19th centuries. They circulated magazines, they circulated films, they've circulated LP long playing records, etc. They had Victrolas. They purchased Victrolas in the community rooms of the Carnegie Libraries, and on Sundays would host Metropolitan Opera things.
And those big Victrolas, those RCA things with the big speakers, right?
Right.
You can still see them in my mind. Not that I go back that far, but almost. Mm-hmm. Now, here's a Facebook comment from Timothy. He says, my local library, the North Beach branch of San Francisco Public Library, looks and feels like a techie kiosk. There are 3 reading chairs and yet 50 computer terminals. Libraries do have that different look now. Let me just read one more email and then we'll go to your calls. And you can email us, forum@kqed.org. Alana writes, our community library, the Ocean View branch of San Francisco Public Library, is amazing. The spectrum of visitors is infinite. There is a community room where we take our children after school for homework help. The librarians know the children and parents, and they help everyone equally, which I think takes a special person to be able to do well. My grandmother was a librarian at the Library of Congress for a time. An aunt was a librarian at Cal State Northridge. I definitely place librarians on a pedestal. So there you are, Wayne.
For what it's worth, librarianship is one of the professions that delivers the most job satisfaction and always has.
And probably has good longevity to boot on the actuarial charts. Let me go to another caller here. Peter, join us. You're on.
Yes, hi. It's Peter Warfield from Library Users Association. Libraries, of course, are wonderful in all the ways that you describe. For myself, it was a place as a kid that I could go for discovery and learning, and especially independent discoveries that were independent of school and of other forces in society. We're concerned with some bad things that are happening with libraries, the privatizations that are occurring, privacy issues with in connection, for example, with a new catalog that includes social media issues. There's no longer in San Francisco Public Library any anonymous searching on the internet possible because you have to have a library card to sign up for every one of the locations except at the main library, two computers. The other thing you mentioned, free and equal access, that's a wonderful thing. There's an issue with regard to fines and fees. The fines, even small ones, can build up to where a person owing $10 or more can't borrow any longer or use interlibrary loan and so on. We're pushing for a fine-free system. And I have to say the library just discussed its budget at the last commission meeting and has a new fine proposed or fee for damage or loss of a PC that they want to include in the new rate structure, $1,000 for damage or loss to a PC, and we think that's just unconscionable.
And enforced by police action, Peter?
No, there's no indication of how it would be enforced, but certainly...
I'm wondering where the teeth are, yeah.
Well, if you didn't pay, you'd have $1,000 owing, and then you couldn't borrow any books, you couldn't use interlibrary loan.
You would be persona non grata in the library, I understand.
Well, you could still go in and use the facilities there, but the $1,000 for damage or loss of a PC, I just think that's something that no patron should be exposed to, and that's included in their proposed fee structure that's included with the budget this year.
Well, Peter, thank you for that update, and I appreciate hearing from you. Peter Warfield's been calling in here whenever we talk about libraries for the almost quarter of a century that I've been behind this microphone. Let me get another caller on, and this is Lee. Lee, you're on.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was really taken aback by the first two emails that you read regarding libraries and the patrons who take offense at the homeless. My son and was raised in the libraries. I've been a library user for more than 30 years. I've used libraries all over the city, and thank goodness there's a refuge for homeless people that provides them with information and some shelter and some peace and civility. Otherwise, those qualities are unavailable to them in the rest of their lives.
Well, Lee, let me read an email from Laura, who seems to be in agreement with you here. She writes, to the person who doesn't want to associate with the great unwashed masses, I say this, most of us are a paycheck away from being there ourselves. I teach at the county jail in Ukiah, and I tell my students, go to the library when they're feeling lost on the outside. This is the only place one can find unconditional support.
So absolutely.
Hear, hear. Yeah, Lee, let me thank you for the call. In fact, what about using the library for child care? There was... some notoriety along those lines, too, in some news stories. You know, people felt it was a safe enough place. I can park my kid there.
I'm going to sound like an old saw, but this is it goes back to the 19th century. Kids would hang out in public libraries rather than go home because their parents were working, both parents were working jobs, et cetera.
Now it's more in the suburbs, though.
Yes, indeed. What some public libraries responded by banning them from coming in the 1960s, 1970s, when problems arose, but other public libraries created programs to help them do their homework, be occupied with productive activities, etc. And I think the latter have won out. We used to call it latchkey kids. I don't know if they call it latchkey kids anymore. But youth programming seems to be an increasing activity in public libraries across the country.
And we go to more of your calls. Let me go to Berkeley next and welcome Balark. You're on the air.
Hi, Mike. I was lucky to be enough when I first came to the U.S. to first move to Rochester, New York, and then over to the Bay Area here in Berkeley, where we have two libraries where you can check out not just books, but also things like screwdrivers, hammers, and also bigger things like power tools and all that. And, you know, being here and, you know, being in a place that is a fixer-upper, you know, it was an invaluable tool, you know, to be able to rent things that would normally cost several hundred dollars and to be able to use it to, you know, fix up where I live and things like that. So I was wondering, are two libraries common across the United States, or is it mostly just some small pockets?
Well, also, I don't think they were giving out power tools back in the 19th century, were they?
No, they weren't, but they were giving out tools.
Yeah. And is that common, he's asking?
Well, I would say it's more common for urban than it is for rural public libraries. I'll remind your listeners that of those 17,219 public library stations, 80% are located in towns of 25,000 population or less. So the services you get from one small town to another would vary considerably depending on what the local community expects of its library. If they don't expect tools to be checked out, then the tools probably won't be provided. But it's very much a the public librarian's perception of what the needs of the community are.
And let me thank the caller and bring another caller on here. Xavier, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. I have, I think, a unique story. In the early 50s, my family were migrant field workers coming from Mexico. We came to the fields and ended up settling in Martinez, in a rural part of Martinez, way far away from the center of Martinez. Every 2 weeks, one of the greatest joys that I had in that time was a school bus that came and was the library, mobile library. And it opened up my world so much, from science fiction to all kinds of things that I would have never known in that area that had no public services. And all we had were fields and hills to enjoy. But it was a fundamental change to have the public library reach out to me in an area where there was no other sources. And I went on and became a student at UC Berkeley during the Black Panther movement, Brown movement. And Doe Library was fundamentally a monument to me, to see such a beautiful, magnificent library, and then to use the Berkeley library system through my adult, and I eventually got my master's degree from the system, because of public library.
Well, that's my story. That's a great story. Thank you, Xavier. From migrant worker to a learned man, from the sounds of it. Not to say that migrants aren't learned, but, finding himself a place and finding himself a profession, too. Here's Connie, who writes, I've lived in many places around the USA and the world, and one of my first actions upon living anywhere is to obtain a library card. When I moved to one of the suburbs in the East Bay around 20 years ago, I was appalled at the size of the library. It was appalling. Having just moved here from Connecticut, where the voters support wonderful libraries, it was very revealing as to the priorities of Californians. I lived in one of the most affluent populations in the country, but the library was small and poorly equipped. I have now lived in several places in the Bay Area and have not found many good libraries. I can drive all the way to the Oakland Library, but nearby there is still very little for library lovers. Any thoughts on this?
What is a good library? An individual, for example, my favorite library in the country is the Library of Congress, and that's because it meets my needs, which are largely research-based. But I couldn't expect the Library of Congress kind of collection to be in my hometown of Walnut Creek, California. So the question is, what is a good library? What expectations do people bring to their library services? If you compare this person with the one who called previously, Xavier, who welcomed once every 2 weeks, a school bus loaded with books coming out into the country. Again, it's what are the expectations?
It's also different communities providing different kind of support, having different, shall we say, commitments where libraries are concerned. It does vary community to community.
It does.
Yeah. Here's Rachel writes, as a child, the home was not a welcoming space, and school had its challenges. But the library was a short bike ride away where I always felt safe. I am so grateful to have had a place to just be when I was young, and I see myself in all those who seek shelter in libraries. And we'll go to more of your calls. Let me go next to you, Catherine. Hi.
Hi.
Yes, you're on the air.
Yeah. Well, I'm calling because I don't think I've heard anyone mention God's greatest invention, the bookmobile.
And you know that was God's invention, right?
It felt like it to me. Third grade, no parents at home, and Friday was the day I could just disappear from the world and go into that bookmobile and spend hours there. Well, at least until the guy had to drive away.
Well, thank you for that. And as I said, we're getting some great stories, wonderful stories from listeners here. Let me just read an email from Elliot. It says, I'm deeply grateful to the Institution of Public Libraries. I haunted the library as a child in a working-class neighborhood back east. Old Mrs. Fuller kindly stamped the book cards with return dates. I inhaled science and science fiction books, and as an adult, I became a professional science fiction writer. And here's Sarah, who tweets, libraries open the door to everyone, full stop. That kind of small D democracy is a dying breed and should be embraced. And here's another listener who says, one of my sweetest childhood memories is tagging along with my mother to the Grand Avenue Branch Library in Oakland, which she pretty much read her way through. I became a voracious reader and then a writer. Libraries are one of the great underappreciated bastions of civilization. You often hear that word about civilized and civilization, don't you, Wayne?
Indeed.
Let me just read another tweet here from Miguel, who says, another type of library to consider is school libraries, friendly and smart staff willing to tutor students for free. Can you talk a little bit about the role or the health of libraries in public schools?
Actually, that's the last research project on my bucket list, is to write a history of the American public school library. When I undertook this research on this history of the American public library, I did it by looking not at the words of the people who funded it and managed it, but at the people who used it. And as a result, I came up with an understanding of how people value so much more the act and the social nature of reading and the library as a physical space. So I'm going to take that theoretical frame into my analysis of the American public school library, as I sense at this point that we're undervaluing school libraries because we're looking at literacy statistics rather than understanding the act of reading in the kind of depth we need to.
Well, we'll look forward to that next project of yours. William Wiegand, our guest, Professor Emeritus of Library and Information Science at Florida State and author of Part of Our Lives, A People's History of the American Public Library, and you are listening to Forum. This is a fundraising period for this radio station. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to another caller, and that's Roger from San Francisco. Good morning.
Yes, thank you, Michael. I just like to mention this, that the library here in San Francisco, and I'm sure other libraries, has a room for people who have a dyslexia or impeded in other ways, that they can get books on CDs. And that's incredibly helpful for people who just have trouble reading. My own personal history with libraries is manifold. I'm really involved with libraries. My wife is a librarian. When I was a boy, I had dyslexia. I had trouble in school. My refuge was the library. When I joined the Marines, I didn't drink. So the first place I went to was the library. It was just, it's so much a part of my life. Right now, I read books, but it takes me where you could read them in a day or a couple days. It takes me a week to get through a book. But library is so incredibly important for people. I don't find the San Francisco Library in any way distasteful. Just go in there and enjoy the books.
All right, Roger. Thank you. Keep reading. Keep listening. Appreciate hearing from you. And here's another library lover. Carol, let me get you on the air. Hi.
Hi, good morning. I echo the previous caller's thoughts. I grew up in Connecticut and was in a very large family, and my mom took us to the library every single week, and we each got a big sack full of books out because our family couldn't afford to buy books. So we're all readers. Our children are readers. My grandchildren are becoming readers. And I just...
Excuse me, Carol, readers in large part because of libraries?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I buy books now, but I way would rather go to the library and get books. And my husband and I probably walk over to our library, I don't know, once a week. And we just love the library. I mean, it's just, there's so much there. And I'm fortunate. Palo Alto has 5 libraries. You know, this is a place that funds their libraries. And in the summer, I live in a tiny little town in New Hampshire, and the first place I go is the library and say hi to everybody and take my grandkids to story hour there. I mean, they're just such a enlivening and enriching part of any community.
Well, thank you, Carol. Good to hear from you and appreciate your call. I'm going to go to some more emails here. A listener writes, please comment on the trend by library administrations towards centralization, wherein only a few spend the entire materials acquisition budget, leading to a narrowing of the collection bias, etc. This trend includes overemphasizing popular materials to the denigration of more serious in-depth materials. Professional librarians are being removed from their traditional duties. Would be worth an entire program. What do you say, Wayne Wiegand?
That's a lot to answer.
yeah, indeed.
But let me address the issue of popular materials versus serious materials. You've heard from a few callers already, for example, about science fiction. For the readers of science fiction, that's serious reading. to isolate other kinds of reading as serious sort of denigrates the that kind of popular reading. And that popular fiction has been the core of public library services since 1854.
There's a kind of academic bias through the years about science fiction I can attest to as an English professor for many years. So I often thought to be not as serious as, you know, what was considered real literature. But there's some wonderful science fiction novels. I mean, I think about Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula Le Guin, books like that that, you know, stand out.
But I also bring you back to Sonia Sotomayor and Nancy Drew. I mean, that was serious stuff for her. And she's now sitting on the Supreme Court.
I remember having an argument with some parents. It's something I think we did a program on. We turned lots of things into product. But there was a series called, when my kids were younger, called Sweet Valley Twins. And they were all about girls wanting to be cheerleaders and everything. And there was a lot of offense, you know, around Sweet Valley High. Excuse me. Thank you. Irene reminded me. You know, this is not, this is like toxic, you know, and it's sexist and all that sort of thing. But the argument was made, and I was more sympathetic to it at the time, that people are just reading. You know, if they're reading, that's the important thing.
And they're improving their vocabularies.
Exactly.
I'm going to go back just to Nancy Drew, and I don't mean to focus entirely on Nancy Drew. You can do the same thing for Hardy Boys, et cetera.
And Harry Potter.
And Harry Potter, indeed. But what was available to young adolescent females at that time was rather restricted. And in Nancy Drew, they found someone, a character, who could be independent, intelligent, and female all at the same time.
Well, in fact, I'm looking at a female email here from Lila, who says, my first kiss was at a public library when I was 10. Woo-hoo. Okay, we'll end on that note. Wayne, good to have you with us. Thank you. Welcome to the Bay Area.
Pleasure.
Wayne Wiegand is the author of Part of Our Lives, A People's History of the American Public Library. And we are here with you Monday. You can continue this discussion online, by the way, kqed.org/forum. Here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our engineer today is Howard Gelman. Our senior editor is Dan Zolin. Our executive producer is Joanne Wallace. And for all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.